Good morning, everybody. I'm very glad to welcome you to this session this morning, Measuring and Communicating Quality. I hope you enjoyed the dinner last night and you're not too tired, but I'm glad you are here. Let me very briefly introduce myself. My name is Marina Signore. I'm Director of Research at ISTAT. I've been working for several years as head of division for metadata and quality, and now I'm an advisor to the director of the newly created directorate for data collection. Okay, regarding this session, measuring and communicating quality, we are all aware of the importance of both aspects of quality. If we don't measure quality, we cannot improve quality and we cannot communicate it to the users. And we know that our production cycle starts from the users by identifying their needs and ends with the users by disseminating statistical information, data, metadata, quality indicators. So the two topics, measuring and communicating quality, are strictly linked to each other. And in this session, we will have a good balance of topics. Some are more specific, some are wider. So I think they might be of interest for you. I would start immediately with the first presentation. I don't want to take your time. So the first presentation is by Genziana Rawson from the Office for National Statistics UK. The title is A Future-Focused Approach to National Statistical Quality Reviews in the UK. And I introduce you briefly Genziana. She's the head of the Government Statistical Service Quality Review Programme in the UK, where she's designing and implementing a new approach to conducting national statistics quality reviews. This approach aims to provide government departments with strategic directions. And before taking this role, she was a senior researcher in knowledge and analysis services at Welsh Government, where she led the redevelopment of Wales' biggest national service. Prior to that, she worked in the Data Collection Methodology Office for National Statistics, UK. So, Genziana, the floor is yours, please.
Thank you, Marina, for that introduction, and a very good morning to you all on this third and last day of the Q 2018. I'll be talking today about our new approach to conducting quality reviews for national statistics in the UK, and touch upon the different approaches to conducting these national statistics quality reviews in the different waves they've been conducted. So with the first one in 2000-2005, when they were conducted by SIEM, followed by another wave in 2012, between 2012 and 2016, when the review was focusing on an output or a set of outputs, and this was around the time when the UK Statistical Authority new structure was agreed. And our new approach starting in 2017. And I'm going to be following that up with coverage of our first national statistics quality review for privacy and data confidentiality methods, which is at the moment ongoing work and very ambitious in its aim. A little bit of context on the drivers and influencers that informed this new approach. And I wanted to start by saying that quality in official and national statistics is fundamental to quality of decision-making at all levels of society. So to ensure that the statistics remain trustworthy, helpful, and represent good value for money, especially in this day and age, the government statistical service needs a program of continuous development and improvement, including periodic quality reviews. Our new approach puts government statisticians and producers of statistics at the center, and we aim to provide them with support to publish statistics that better reflect the changing structure and the characteristics of the economy and society, embrace a culture focused on helping better meet current as well as emergent needs, and make the most of the new data sources and technologies, and respond to the challenges posed by the data revolution and emerging data science techniques. There is a need for statistics and to be reviewed in a wider context, and for that reason, for this national statistics quality reviews, we are going to be taking a GSS-wide approach. GSS is Government Statistical Service, and the statistics will be reviewed by theme, as long as the theme is strategic and of national importance. And one key aspect is that we are aiming to maximize and make better use of advice and expertise from outside the government statistical service, as well as the expertise already existing in the different government departments. At the moment, in the UK, we have two programs of quality reviews led by two different organizations. Systemic reviews are led by Office for Statistical Regulations, and Ed was had a presentation about the new code of practice yesterday. And then SQRs are led by the Best Practice and Impact Division in the Methods Data Research. This is a new division that has been set up to better share good practice and to support government statisticians across the different government departments. There are some similarities as well as some key differences between the two types of reviews. I think a key point is that for the NSQRs, the ideas will be generated with and in collaboration with the government statistical service, and the leaning will be towards methodology and quality issues and preparing GSS for the future. In the interest of time, I'm just only going to briefly touch on the first wave of national statistics quality reviews that was conducted between 2000 and 2005. They were reviews by theme across the different departments. One of the key issues and concerns and comments about this approach was that it was very time-consuming, very resource-intensive, and at times the reviews were done by methodologies from within the area being reviewed, and there was a need for external experts to be leading these reviews in order to enhance to be more credible. This was followed by a second wave of national statistics quality reviews that took place between 2012 and 2016. These were different from the previous approach in that they only reviewed statistical outputs from within ONS. They focus on one output or a set of outputs, and the review was following the traditional GSBPM model, going through all the stages of these reviews. If I would need to explain or define what a national statistics quality review is and isn't, it would be very difficult because there are different approaches taken to different reviews at different times. So, for example, the National Accounts and Balance and Payments, NSQR, was done completely by external experts, while the other NSQRs were done by led by a methodologist and done with representatives of the output areas and some external expert input, but more in terms of quality assuring the process rather than being directly involved in the review. So to summarize, what are the key differences between the last approach and the new approach? We're moving away from reviewing an output or a set of outputs to reviewing a theme. We're moving away from having methodologies within ONS choosing the topics and surveys outputs reviewed to working collaboratively with other GSS departments to generate ideas and select the right ones to take forward in a national statistics quality review. The focus will be on methodological and quality issues with the aim of preparing GSS for the future. We need to make sure that our methods are not only fit for purpose at this point in time, but we're taking into consideration the developments already taking place elsewhere to align the methods and invest in the development of these methods so they will be fit for purpose in 3 or 5 years' time. And the questions are around how do we know when methods are fit for purpose, what are we assessing against, and what is our starting point. And another key difference is that the reviews will be led by world-leading experts in these methods with statisticians from across the different government departments being heavily involved throughout the process. I will be talking now about our first privacy and data first national statistics quality review, which is a review of the privacy and data confidentiality methods. This is still ongoing work, and we are aiming to finish this first NSQR in end of September, beginning of October this year. During the selection process and choosing a topic and a theme for the first review, with the challenge that we can't impose these reviews in other on other government departments, we can only provide them as a service. We've considered a couple of some very big issues in the current context of the UK, such as migration statistics and trade statistics. It became apparent in early engagement with the other government departments that this is probably not the best choice for the first theme. And we came to an agreement having the first NSQR as covering privacy and data confidentiality methods, and that was for strategic purposes, to support the move towards increasing the use of non-survey data, as well as ensuring that GSS is prepared for this increase of use in alternative data sources and help support them produce flexible outputs to better aid timelier decisions. The focus is on adding value, and also the time at which we are conducting this review is with the data protection regulation, General Data Protection Regulation Act, the new code of practice that came into effect earlier this year, as well as the Digital Economy Act. We have two phases. The first phase, where we're gathering input from leaders in the field and try to better understand the privacy and data confidentiality tools and methods used across GSS, followed by a response phase in which we will be supporting the different government departments towards implementing the new improved methods, and we have a couple of channels to do that. We have refreshed the GSS Methodology Advisory Committee and to make sure that we have some leading experts advising us on the different topics, as well as providing us with a peer review function throughout the process. And to summarize, then SQR is moving away from a review that is done to statistical producers to a review that is done with statistical producer, thinking of an SQR as a critical friend with the aim of supporting GSS to move collectively towards improved method and tools. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Genziana, for this very comprehensive presentation. I would like now to invite our second speaker. The title of the presentation is An Empirical Study of the Effect of High, Low, Moderate Non-Response Rate on the Quality of Survey Estimates. Owen Kleven from Statistics Norway. And she is a senior statistics advisor at Statistics Norway. He started his career in Statistics Norway at the Division for Sample Surveys in 1998. He has a master in political science and is currently working with election statistics, analyzing data from registers and surveys. From 2009-2015, he was the head of Division for Survey Planning, and later the Division for Data Collection Methodology. He has published several articles on non-sampling errors and political participation. Please, the floor is yours.
Oh, thank you. Do you hear me? Yeah. Well, good morning. We have a project in Statistics Norway that we call the an empirical study of the effect of high, low, or moderate non-response rates on the quality of survey estimates. Today, I'm presenting the first empirical results of the project. So this is a work in progress. It's me, Ib Thompson, and Lee Chun Chang. I'm the subject matter guy. Those two other guys are more methodologists who is more interested in how we can generalize our findings. In this empirical study, we focus on the Norwegian National Election Survey from 1969 to 2017, combined with link administrative sources, which provide additional data of electoral turnout and population demographic characteristics. The non-response rate has increased steadily in most surveys, in most countries. In the election survey, has increased from 10% in 1969 to about 40% in the latest round. Now, in 1969, they used about 2 weeks to reach a response rate of 90%. In the middle of 2005, we used maybe 4 or 5 months to reach about 70%. So this has a huge impact on the costs, and it started in Stat Norway and other academic institutions, the statistical institutions, to question whether is it worth it? Is it like what's the connection between non-response and non-response bias? Of course, non-response errors is the difference between the statistics computed from collected data and those that would be computed if there were no missing values. During the last 50 years, Statistics Norway has made systematic efforts to integrate various administrative data for statistical purposes. Every person living in Norway have a unique identifier, a national ID number. All prospective voters must be included with their full name, address, and the national ID number in the electoral register. And official statistics on electoral turnout by background variables like gender, age, and level of education is today estimated mainly by Statistics Norway by registers, MERS, by the electoral register, and other registers Statistics Norway have access to. When Stat Norway performed their first election survey back in 1969, the national ID number was in place. So when the sample for the first survey was done, it was drawn directly from the electoral register. And also in 1969, they started a tradition that they sent the whole sample to the local voting committee so they could check whether a person has voted or not and send back the Statistics Norway. This means that we can, in our estimates, we don't have sampling errors and we don't have other non-sampling errors like measurement errors and coverage errors and so on. So we can kind of just compare those two samples with the net sample and say something about the effect of non-response. That was kind of a long introduction to this. So this is the response rates in election surveys. And we have by gender and age, and we can see that although the response rates are dropping, it's also dropping among males, and different age groups. So what we then need is kind of an indicator, an easy indicator, which is easy to produce in statistical production, and is easy to communicate to our users. This is a huge debate in Norway about the future of sample surveys because the non-response rates are dropping. And we need something kind of simple way to communicate what's the impact of the non-response and the non-response bias. In statistical production, we try to keep things in a standardized way. We're not necessarily interested in the non-response bias by any obscure variable. It is kind of like age, gender, education, and so on. So what they have always done in statistical production is to produce tables where they just compare the distribution by some variables in the registers, which we call X's, and with the same distribution in the sample who has responded in the survey. And you can just make tables like this. If you combine age and gender, and then you can say that that's the bias in each cell. And if you just take the absolute value of any given year, say 2017, you take away the minus and the plus, and you sum this up, you have what we call a bias indicator, which we call a BIX. It's a bias in the X's. If there's the response rate is the same in every cell, the BIX will be zero. If it's, say, all the males respond, none of the females respond, it will be 100. This is easy to explain to users. So how has this evolved over time? Back from 1969, you can see that the non-response rates are going up quite high. And you can see that the BIX, well, not much going on. And one other thing is that the bias in turnout, you see that this is also going up. So there is a clear correlation between when the response rates are dropping, we get more bias. And this is not hard to explain. That means that people who are interested in politics tend to vote and they tend to want to participate in our survey. If you're in a hospital, you don't get all of you and you don't get to go to vote. So that's not a big secret. And from 1997, we started with electronical CAI, computer assisted engineering. And then we get more data and we get more paradata, so we can do more analysis. 97 was actually the year I started to work on the survey, so I've been on that survey for 20 years. And you can see that when we include education in the BICS, you see a clearer picture that there is some association. When the non-response rate is going up, the bias is always also going up. But then there's a question, is the glass half full or half empty? Some would say that, well, that's not a lot. In 1997, we have a 30% non-response rate. In 2015, we have like 45%. And I don't think that the difference is that big. Anyway, we can conclude that you don't want more non-response. But then it's the questions, do you want to pay for going from 50% response rate to 60% response rate, and so on. So that what we're doing is we simulate different scenarios based on our paradata. What would happen if we say we have a response rate of 25%, between 25 and 50, and over 50? What you will see here is that the true value in the sample is 80%. And when we get a response rate of about 62% in 2017, and if we re-weight it by some background variable, we'll get an estimate of 86. So we kind of have 6% bias. If you had say, well, we can live at 25%, we will have a 90%. So we kind of lose precision about 4%. This clearly shows that there is a connection between some server variables and non-response. But this can not necessarily be generalized to all the other variables in the survey. There's a 1 hour long interview. So what we are doing is looking into other target variables. And we also have other surveys when we do the election, some self-completion by the web, which is a simple random sample. And we can, the day after the election, we just send it out. And we can then see if we had stopped by 1 day, 1 week, with lower response rate, what would happen to any given variable. What we're saying is that if you have very low response rates, you're risking in an attitudinal variable like
2 minutes.
2 minutes. Nobody will theoretically tick off 8 or 7. You might get a danger of social desirability, political correctness in answering. But when we looked at this, we were quite surprised. If you just look at this, the re-weighted day one and full net samples on the right side, after 1 day, we get 14% response rate. And after 4 weeks, we have a 43% response rate. And we weighted by some background variables. And you see that there's not much going on. Starting to generalize to say that, okay, political behavior, there is a clear connection between response rates and bias, but in attitudinal variables, it's not that clear. And you should be careful to generalize. And this is the first results, and we will do a lot of more simulations, play around with this more. And I think that was all I had to say.
Thank you very much for this very interesting presentation. It was very stimulating. And we will now move to our third speaker. Is Christos Liouris from Eurostat. The title of the presentation is Measuring, Reporting and Communicating Quality of National Account Statistics in an Integrated Way with Data Production. Let me briefly introduce you, Christos. Christos has a background in spatial planning and economics, Since 2014, he is a member of the Institutional Sector Accounts team in the National Accounts Unit of Eurostat. He is here today to talk us, as I said, about the annual exercise on national and regional accounts quality reporting, having taken over its coordination since last December. So please, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good morning, everyone. As Google Translate tells me, that's Dzień dobry wszystkim in Polish. I hope I managed. And by the way, dziękuję for a very nice conference dinner to the organizers last night and a very well organized conference. So as it was mentioned, I will talk to you about today about the annual exercise that we started implementing in Eurostat with the help of the member states and the EFTA countries since last year. And here is the briefly the outline of my presentation. It's not long, I promise. So we'll see the legislative framework for quality reporting, the structure and the indicators, very shortly, the automation of data production, some implementation and examples from the implementation from last year's exercise, and the challenges for future work. Regarding the legislative framework for quality reporting, it's mainly two regulations that we take into account. So it's Article 4 of Regulation 549/2013 that established the ISA 2010 system of accounts, and the implementation, the specifications of these implementations are further defined in the implementing regulation of the Commission number 2304 of 2016. What does that foresee? It foresees that the main indicators, the assessment indicators, are divided into two categories. It's the quantitative indicators. These are pre-filled by Eurostat with the data that we already have received by the countries. And it's things like completeness rate of the tables, so how many data we were expecting to how much we received. Punctuality and delivery dates, if some table was delivered after the deadline, for example. A revision rate and coherence between variables within and between tables. So on this point, I have to say that regarding the coherence, already what is implemented is the coherence between annual and quarterly data for main aggregates and sector accounts domains. Then we have the coherence between tables of the same domain, in this case main aggregates, and also the sum of components to the total that is transmitted already is implemented for main aggregates. Regarding coherence between domains, this is foreseen for a little bit later, 2021, with the exception of the coherence regarding net lending borrowing in tables of sector accounts and financial accounts. This will be implemented in the coming exercise in February 2019 already. Which data we choose to measure all these indicators is based also on the regulation that says that unless otherwise specified, it's the most recent vintage of the country's data published on Eurostat's website. Regarding qualitative indicators, this is filled in by member states. It's some text and comments that they may possibly have on data revision policy, if, for example, they did a benchmark revision in the previous year, and the documentation on methodology. There is also provision for providing some comment on length of comparable time series over time, but this is becomes also obligatory in 2021. As for the implementation process, the indicators, the quality exercise are implemented gradually. It started in 2017 with less. Then in 2018, we had also some new things to add. There is more coming in 2019. And then in 2021, it will take the final version, its final form, when most of the derogations of, I think all, the derogations on ISA 2010 tables will have expired. How it works, each year by mid-February, Eurostat, as it was mentioned, provides to the member states draft national quality reports pre-filled with the indicators based on the data that we have received from them. Then by the end of May, 31st of May, the member states and the countries, the EFTA countries, have to provide Eurostat, any possible comments that they may have on anything that may disagree or indicate their plans for improvement on some specific indicator. And then after we agree on the final, we accept we may accept the comments and maybe correct something. After we agree on the final report, we have the final national quality reports, and based on those, we finalize the Eurostat's overall assessment that subsequently is used in the published quality report. How it's done on IT level, very shortly, the challenges were three: to compute the indicators from the existing data that we have, to integrate them into the standard ESQRS structure and implementing the metadata handler, which is not very easy, I have to admit, and then to ensure that the qualitative indicators can also be automatically extracted from the production database and integrated into the quality reports without manual intervention. These challenges are met by using the SDMX standard as an enabler for the exchange of information across the different systems. And it is true that we have different IT environments, so some difficulty comes from there, because in Eurostat we have MDT, SUIOT, supply use tables, used for example Microsoft deployment toolkit for their production. Then the regional accounts use OLAP, online analytical processing. Everybody else is using FAME. Some use it, FAME even differently than other sectors, so all this has to be reconciled and somehow toward it to the metadata handler to publish the reports. This is in a diagram, very condensed, what I just mentioned. So I'll move on. Regarding some examples, it's true. We can see that the quality exercise really helps countries. As you can see, this is the data availability. You can see that from 2015 to 2018, there is already a lot of improvement. The blue means full data delivery for tables by countries. The green, almost complete. The yellow, some shortcomings. And the red, major shortcomings or no data delivery. So you can see that between 2015 and 2018, from 64%, we are now in 81% full data delivery. And as a whole, it's getting better. And it's true because also the countries admit that sometimes the quality reporting exercise helps them identify some areas that they have some issue that maybe they didn't even know of, and then they improve this, and as a whole they become better. This is the timeliness. This is an example from main aggregates, for example. And here you can see that when 2017 was a year where many derogations expired, and you can see this here. So for annual especially, and also for quarterly data a little bit less than annual, the timeliness was not the best. Some tables were not on time. But the general, I think, finding from this graph is that while there were more tables, a little bit more tables in 2017 that were not delivered on time compared to 2016, still the time for which the users had to wait was less per table. So at least that's a good sign. Regarding coherence, looks okay. You can see that there are some differences, for example, between annual data and some of the quarters, or between average and maximum absolute difference in coherence within between tables. In most cases, it's not big differences, and as the member states and the countries are informing us, it's mostly due to different vintages. As a whole, we can see that in the last column, for example, the number of countries with significant findings has also is less in 2017 than 2016, okay, with the exception of quarterly, the third part of the table over there. Regarding challenges for future work, as the regulation foresees, we have to do the extension of the exercise. It is foreseen that the scope of the exercise will be extended in 2019 and then in 2021 already. A big bet, I would say, for Eurostat is to do this second point, to create a consolidation environment. As I told you already, we have different production environments in the different units. This consolidation database will help greatly in having all the data into one database, and then, of course, like this, the implementation of the quality exercise will also become easier for Eurostat and for the countries. And then there is also the will to explore a possible linking of FISA 2010 metadata and the national quality reports in mid-term, with the approval, of course, it has to be discussed in the National Accounts Working Group, with the approval of the countries. And then on the IT side, our IT people are looking for a better solution, if possible, for the integration of data tables within SDMX metadata sets to resolve any current performance issues. So that's all from me. I would like to say, to finalize, that the key message is that the quality exercise really helps countries notice any shortcomings and improve. And that's a very good sign, and it's very good to hear. And it also helps Eurostat as well with all the effort that we put into implementing this quality exercise. So as a whole, I would say the quality report exercise makes us all, helps us all become better statisticians. I will close here by saying that I have, if you're interested, I have the first report that was drafted. It was published this May. I have it in a PDF file with me, but also I can let you know if you like where to look for it on Eurostat website. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Christos. That was very interesting for us to know about this exercise from Eurostat, which is really relevant. I would like now to introduce the next speaker. You all know that him is Paul Beamer, but I will anyway introduce him with a few words. The title of his presentation is Quality Management for Official Statistics, Some Lessons Learned After 7 Years of Aspire. And as you all know, Paul is a distinguished fellow at the RTI International and the Associate Director of Research for the Odum Institute at the University of North Carolina. His latest book, titled Total Survey Error in Practice, was published by Wiley in 2017. He's one of the organizers of the Big Serve 18 conference, Big Data Meets Survey Science, which will be held in Barcelona in October, and co-editor of the book from the conference that will be published in early 2020. So this is an invitation to attend the conference.
Exactly, a little plug, shameless plug, if you don't mind. Well, thank you, Marina.
Please.
And good morning, everyone. So this morning I'm going to be talking about a quality management program called Aspire. Aspire was developed at Statistics Sweden in 2011. And since then, the process has been applied annually to about 10 products for a total of 7 rounds. We call these annual evaluations rounds. And so what I thought I would do this morning is just give you a little background on what Aspire is, how it works. I don't have a lot of time, but then I would like to finish with some lessons that we've learned over these 7 rounds of applying it. Before I move on, I want to recognize my co-authors, Heather Bergdahl and Joachim Malden, who are both in the audience today. I would also like to recognize these three people who contributed to Aspire: Lily Japek, Dennis Truen, and Dan Kasperzik. So the name Aspire is an acronym that means a system for product improvement, review, and evaluation. So basically, It's a set of principles that basically focuses on accuracy. So it's built on a total error concept that is trying to minimize the total error in a statistical product for a given cost, which is very different than, say, a fitness for purpose type of objective. It uses external reviewers. I'm one of the external reviewers. Dennis Truen, we were the two original external reviewers. Since then, we've added additional reviewers. And we believe that gives a little bit more objectivity to the process. And as I mentioned, we've been applying this for 7 consecutive years. And each time we apply it, we write a full report, which is provided to the Director General of Statistics Sweden, as well as the Swedish Ministry of Finance. Now, some of the general features of Aspire, basically, it begins with a review, sort of a paper review of a statistical product. As I mentioned, there's roughly 10 statistical products that we look at every year. These are more or less the same 10 products every year. So there's some switching in and out of some products, but essentially it's the same 10 products that we're reviewing for all 7 rounds. So the first time we review a product, we look very intensively, do a lot of reading about that, look at the quality declarations associated with it, and then we meet in Sweden to conduct a review. And these reviews can last, couple hours, several hours in some instances, where we go through the product in a lot of detail, and basically it's a systematic process where we're basically covering all of the potential sources of error associated with that particular product, and then we apply a set of guidelines, criteria, I should say, quality criteria, which are informed by these guidelines that we're using, and basically rate each of the error sources according to the criteria to come up with a score. And then those scores can be combined in various ways. You can get a score for each error source, you can get a score for each product, you can get an overall score, and so forth. So the staff are very much involved in this process, and they have an opportunity to review their scores, and they want to contest the scores and discuss the scores, they're able to do that. So it's a very interactive process. Now, there are 6 components associated with the Aspire process. The first one, as I mentioned, this is based on an error, minimum error approach. So there's an error decomposition model that forms the sort of the foundation of Aspire, and I'll go through that in a minute. There are quality criteria. So you will see in a minute there are 8 error sources, potential error sources associated with the product. And we have 6 criteria. So if you cross that, we have about 48 cells, error by criteria cells. And each cell, then, we assign a rating on a scale of 1 to 10. And then that then forms sort of the rating matrix. In order to be able to try to be consistent, because the expert reviewers sometimes are split into, doing parallel reviews. And so the question of, how do you maintain consistency across reviewers and across products and so forth is a question. So we've developed these guidelines and a checklist, which also aids us in to be able to apply consistently the same criteria in the same way across all the different products that we're reviewing. There's the ratings, as I'll mention, and I'll get into that in a few minutes, and as I mentioned, it's on a scale of 1 to 10. And very importantly, there's a risk assessment. So as I mentioned, there are these 8 error sources, and each error source is rated, is assigned a risk level, and we're only using 3 levels of risk, a low, medium, and high risk. And these risks are based upon the intrinsic risk. What I mean by that is basically, what is the risk that this error source poses to this product if there were no mitigation efforts? For example, non-response. How much bias would there be in this product as a result of non-response if we didn't take all these steps to try to reduce the non-response bias by adjustments, modeling, and those kinds of things? And so this gives us a way of basically assigning an importance to the particular error source, and that risk actually becomes a weight when we add up all the scores for the error sources. We weight those error sources by that risk level. And there's also a process for routinely following up, and when, as I mentioned, if you have this matrix with 48 cells and you can compute the ratings, assign a rating to each of these cells and compute all these different statistics based upon these ratings, each year when we repeat this process for a product, we will update those ratings, and then the progress that a product is making towards continual improvement is essentially the change in the ratings. So you can look at these changes from year to year in the ratings, and I'll show you that in a moment. And then that sort of is an indicator of how much progress is being made to try to improve the processes associated with that product. So here I'm going to show I show the error structure that we're using here. And on the left-hand side is the difference between, and I'm going to start with a preliminary estimate because some of these products actually publish preliminary estimates. So we have to account for the fact that the preliminary estimate and the final estimates could be different, and which is not a good thing. We would prefer that they be close together. So on the left-hand side, you have sort of the total error, and the right-hand side is a decomposition. And that decomposition is first the revision error. So the revision error essentially is the difference between the preliminary estimate and the final estimate, which is y hat. And then the middle component is a combination of about six other error sources, sampling error, frame error, and et cetera. You can read the list there. And it is the difference between the final estimate and what we would call an error-free version of the parameter as measured by the questionnaire. So what y is basically is the value of the parameter that we would estimate based upon the questionnaire. And the last term is the difference between that value and the construct we're trying to measure. So often we find that what the questionnaire is measuring and the construct that we want to measure, there's a difference, and we call that specification error. So when you look at all of these different, this decomposition, then you arrive at these eight components of error. Now, not all of these components of error will apply to every product. Some products don't have sampling, so there's no sampling error. Some products don't have preliminary estimates, so there's no revision error. Most of the other error sources, however, are associated with these products. Now, I should mention that the Aspire process is not just applied to surveys, which is what this model is basically describing, is a total error in a survey estimate. But we also apply this to registers, and a register would have a very different decomposition that I don't have time to show this morning. But we also apply it to indices like the CPI, and we apply it to compilations, what we call compilations, which is the GDP and national accounts estimates. Very, very different error structure here. And if you want more information about what those error structures look like, I'll refer you to some publications that we have at the end of the presentation, and you can read more about that. So as I mentioned, we have these six criteria, and I don't have time to go into exactly how we arrive at these six criteria. I will mention, however, at first we only had five criteria, the first five you see on this list, and then we added the sixth one because we realized that where people were doing a lot of planning to try to reduce the error risk associated with a particular product, they were not taking that a step further and actually measuring the effectiveness of those mitigation efforts. And in a lot of cases, their efforts were not successful, but they weren't really determining that because there wasn't any measurement of the effectiveness of the mitigation measures. And I'll show you in a minute the impact that that had on the ratings when we add that sixth criteria. But the criteria basically are trying to establish whether there is knowledge about the errors, do they know what specification error is, and are they aware of how that might affect the product's accuracy? Do they communicate that with their users and with the providers, people who provide them with data, and these could be internal providers? Is there expertise enough within the staff to actually deal with the error risk and mitigate them? Are they complying with standards, or they go beyond just standards and actually achieving best practices in the field? What are they doing to plan for the mitigation, and then how effective is it? And then there's the ratings that I mentioned. At first, we do a five-point rating, poor to excellent, and then we refine that with a high-low in each of the these five ratings to come up with a 10-point scale. And also we'll show you in a minute a graph that we try to visualize what these ratings look like. And then I mentioned the risk levels, high, medium, and low. Here's a list of the products that we've reviewed. You can see that some of these are surveys, some of these are census surveys, some of these, in other words, no sampling, some of these are indices, and of course we have compilations, GDP, and so forth. So it's a real mixed bag. But these are determined to be sort of the most important products that Statistics Sweden is dealing with, and so that's why they're in this evaluation process. There are plans to expand this beyond just these. I wish I had more time to really dwell on this chart. There's a number of graphics that we publish as a result of during the Aspire process, and this is sort of the overview. In this graph, you see along the rows here are the error sources, the eight error sources I mentioned. Frame error is broken down a little bit further for the for basically what we call the register error, frame error. And then along the columns, you have the different products, the LFS, the CPI, et cetera. You can look at the mean ratings along the last row for each error source. You can look at the mean ratings for each product at the bottom there. And here we show the round six against the round seven, so you can actually gauge improvement for each survey, how much they've improved in their ratings. And the shading has to do with the risk levels. Now here's another sort of broad chart that shows how the overall ratings for all products has improved for over the seven rounds. And you can see that at round five, we sort of fall off the cliff, right? The bar at round five, old versus new, old means the five criteria without the effectiveness criterion added, and then the new is with the effectiveness criterion added. So you can see that how much lower the ratings are when we add, are the mitigation efforts that they're applying, are they effective in reducing error? It turned out that no one was really evaluating that. And to the extent that they did, it was showing that there was no result. In other words, it was sort of a null finding. It wasn't mitigating the error. And then what we do see, however, is that things are generally improving over time, which is what we hope for. But I believe that these are unbiased ratings because, again, we're pretty harsh in our rating because we're external reviewers, and we believe that it needs to have that level of objectivity. Let me just skip to some of the lessons learned now before I run out of time. So what we've found is that the ratings will increase rapidly initially, but then they'll trail off. And this is sort of the low-hanging fruit syndrome. What's happening is that some of these criteria are very easy to satisfy once they know about them. And they will focus on sort of those because they're easy to do. They don't require a lot of cost. But once those are done, it becomes a little harder than to make improvements, and so you'll sort of see them plateau. Also, we found that 1 year is not, once you get along in the process, say the three or four, when all the low-hanging fruit has been picked, a year is not much time to actually do a lot because they have everything else they're doing. They just can't drop some things and pick up some of the recommendations that we're making in Aspire for making quality improvements. Even though they're working on them, it takes longer to make some progress. And so this is one of the things that we're considering is maybe going to every other year review instead of annual reviews. As I mentioned, effectiveness of the error mitigation activities is the most difficult criterion. The most challenging product by far is GDP because it has so much complexity, so many moving parts there, and the error structure is very different than what I've showed you here. And I'll give you some articles in a minute you can read about that. We also do the self-evaluation, so before we begin the Aspire process, we ask each of the product staffs to actually do a self-evaluation. While those are very useful, they're not very objective, that's for sure. But they're still very useful to sort of gauge what are the improvements that have been made and sort of hear their part, from their perspective, what they think they have done to accomplish improvements in quality. We believe the external reviewers can add a lot of value here. It's more expensive than using internal reviewers, for sure. But we also find that some of the expert reviewers, it's very difficult to find an expert who is expert in both economic and demographic statistics. And so, for example, Dennis Truen, his forte very much lies in the camp of economic statistics and national accounts, where mine is more in sort of demographic surveys, labor force, and those kinds of things. And so together we make a pretty good team here. However, each one of us individually probably couldn't handle all of the different things that are thrown at us from an expert review process. And then we do also do cross-cutting recommendations. So when we go through and we look at all these products, we find that there are some sort of commonalities across them where the improvements need to be at the organizational level. Individual products will just be sort of, you know, incapable of making changes that are at more of a organizational level. And so we pull those kinds of recommendations out and provide them to the director general as sort of saying, you know, these are cross-cutting issues that the organization needs to deal with. But there's a problem there in that, you know, organizations aren't really set up to deal with these cross-cutting issues because, you know, they have silos and so forth associated with their organizations. And so it becomes more difficult for them to organize and try to deal with more cross-cutting issues. So I want to leave you with a couple of articles here that we've written on Aspire. If you're interested in pursuing it, I encourage you to find these articles. Okay. And thank you.
Thank you, Paul. That was really interesting for everybody. We ran a little bit out of time, but I think everybody was really interested in hearing from you. So now our last but not least presenter is Justin Wynn, United States Bureau of the Census. His presentation is automatically generated quality control tables and quality improvement programs. Let me introduce you Justin Wynn. Justin is a mathematical statistician at the U.S. Bureau, Census Bureau. He's currently the chief of quality assessment staff and the lead auditor in the Economic Directorate. Justin attended Missouri State University and Iowa State University. His research interests include mathematical probability and statistical design experiments. So please, Justin, the floor is yours.
Thank you, and good morning. I think, I'm the last person of our section, so I'm going to move on and wrap it up in a moment, and then the remaining time is for your questions. All right, so what we are sharing with us today is based on a research our team and myself working on not long ago. And the motive of this research is we believe that the agency over-edited the data. So with that, we try to propose and conduct using the big data and paired data to provide the evidence, empirical evidence, and try to reduce or get the amount of edit. So before I move on, I would like to acknowledge to my co-author, Karma Hoke, and for her hard work on this presentation. So here is the agenda for our talk today. So basically, I just go over and provide us the overview of the quality audit at the U.S. Census Bureau, and I share with us all the challenges we are facing, and provide some of the methodology how to automate all those standards, quality standards, into the enterprise system, and then we also share with us about the future work. So basically what we did is, so the motive question is how do we improve the quality of our data? And we'd use the quality standards and we audit. The first round we selected 75 surveys in the Census Bureau. And we divided two phases. So the first phase we'd audit 31 surveys and the remaining of the surveys we use on the second round. So based on the first phase, we found that 87% of all those surveys are compliant with the quality standard. So once again, compliant doesn't mean that these surveys doesn't have any recommendations or the suggestions for improvement. So compliant means that they worked and they used all those standards accordingly. All right, and we also filed one outstanding program that doesn't need or have any recommendations or the suggestions for improvement. And among those 31 surveys, we found that 38 standards are non-compliant to those. So here is the question is, so here the question is, we also found something very interesting for those surveyed. We provided 5 years ago, we provided all those recommendations, and the analyst went in and corrected all those suggestions. However, on the second round, we found that all those problems exist in the program. So the main question is, what caused all these problems? Why we couldn't fix it, even though we tried so many times and the problem's still there? All right, so we found that whenever we ask the analyst to document, it doesn't seem like they know what they need to document, or with a lack of documentation. Or even though we ask them to document, and we feel there's a lot of reluctance from those analysts, and they ask, when we say, hey, you need to document all those like procedures or the processes, and the action always, what did I do? What did I do wrong? So it seemed like, okay, it's just a punishment to them if we ask them to document what they do or what they are going to do. And the second thing we found that the program managers or upper management, they have a difficult time to locate all those documentations, even though they exist in the system. And at the U.S. Census Bureau, we work with multiple other agencies outside of the Bureau, and we work with multiple sponsors. So some of the survey is very sensitive data, so all those like sponsor over the agency, we don't have full access to all those documentation. So it's outside of the vendor. So that means we don't have all those documents to follow what we are doing or what they did. So here is, regardless of what we have or what we don't have, our team is, we need to correct all the issues for decades and improve the quality of the data. So what we do is we just based on what information we have, and we aim to produce the highest quality of our data, and we improve all the processes. For example, we try to automate all those standards rather than we ask the analyst, you have to do A, B, C, and so on and so forth. So we build the automate system, and we put into the enterprise system and track on all those processes. And we also develop quality control procedures, and we monitor and evaluate all those processes during the survey collection and survey life cycle. All right, so here is an example of how we improve the quality of the data. So we track in, we build in the quality control system, and we track on the non-respond bias analysis. Total quantity response rate and unit response rate. So that means the analyst doesn't have to go to the spreadsheet or Excel and provide all the information. The reason why we do this, because human, we bias. So if we do this, we can reduce all the biases added to the system. So we use the system to calculate and track on all those things. And we also monitor response rate, monitor complete, incomplete, and follow-up interview cases, refusals, and not able to contact, and so on and so forth. So everything is automated in the system to improve the quality. And the last but not least, we propose the method of big data metrics and the table blocks. So I'm going to go through all those procedures we propose to the analyst. So the first table, so this one is one of the example table. So from now on, analysts doesn't have to calculate all those response rates and non-response rate and refusal cases. So the system automatically calculates all these quantities. So as you see here, most of the survey at the U.S. Census Bureau, we use the web survey. So that means we don't need staff to transfer from the paper form to the database. So everything is whenever respondents hit the submission, all those cases transfer to the computer. So with that, it's very easy for us to calculate all those quantities. So as you see here, around the 30, the day of 30. So that means, okay, we have to send a reminder to the respondent. That's that have to mail to get all those like request information. So with that, the system always generated, and we try to build a reminder. So if when we get to this day and we haven't yet got all the information, it's sent to our email and lets us know that, hey, we have to follow up with like whoever that is, haven't yet like done all these cases back. So with that, we see that we improved the response rates with the goal of 72%. And we have that around the day offer to 40. So we got okay, exactly what we have. So with that, we can just like stop the process and save all those resources and move on to like a different like a project or task. All right, so here is another thing we do is we try to automate all those procedures in the survey lifecycle from planning and development or data collections to the data dissemination. Once again, I'm not going over into detail of all those like tasks. I just give us okay, the information. That's okay, we check in this, and we have a lot of detail on the papers if anyone interested to see what how it works. And similar to this table, basically we divided all those procedures into five different categories. So if you look at the first column, that is what it is. So from the designer, survey designer to documentation. So those are two columns in the middle. That number means the Census Bureau quality standard. So those quality standard, we took a look and we believe it's very easy for us to automate rather than ask the analyst eyeball every single standard and check on the list. So that's what we try to do and we save a lot of time on this one. And this one also, and this is for example, so before the data collection, during the data collection, and after data collection. So what we do is before data collection, we prioritize for the task. Meaning that's okay, we have to put all the efforts in this because we are realizing that to correct the problem during the data collection, it costs way, way much money than before that. So we prioritize this, so any instrument, any procedure, we have to run the test thoroughly, make sure that it works the way we intended it to be. If any problems occur, we have to correct it before the data collection phase. And then after that, so we have to collect all those documentation and we have to do thoroughly evaluate it using those documentations. All right, so here is as I mentioned like earlier, we believe that we over data, the data, meaning that the analysts, they did a lot of time, okay, they did a lot of work and they spent a whole lot of time. However, the final estimate doesn't change before and after. So what we do is we separate those data, like before they made the edits, or they made edits, like some of them they made about 40 or 50 times. So we use that the last number they have and the very last one they kept it in the system and we run the estimate before and after to see any differences in the total estimate and we found that okay, it doesn't show any like significant differences. The thing is because we publish the data at the state level and at the total level, the national level. So basically we don't have to look at every tree in the forest, we just like focus the time for the whole forest. So that's exactly what we are doing here. So we'd hoped to apply the big data and table plot to build more adaptive editing into the system. So hopefully those editing process or procedure repeatable rather than we make changes every single time. And as I mentioned, the machine edit. So we try to reduce all the human error added into the data during the edit process. And then if we do that, we reduce the cost and we improve the quality of the data and we save a whole lot of time. So this graph I'm going to show with us is we use the table plot and the big data to save the edit and make it more adaptive editing. So basically what is shown here is for the very first graph. So what we use is we use 43,000 sectors of one of the survey we're working on and all those 43,000 sectors, we divide into 100 groups with equal number of sectors. So basically, one group has 4,300. I can't, sectors. And we calculated the mean and the standard deviation of those prior year and current year. So the first graph we use as the prior year. So the middle line, that is the mean, and then the lines outside, that is the standard deviation. One of very last one, the blue horizontal line, is negative. And this one, we have no idea what is going on. And we spoke to the analysts, and they realized, okay, something that is. But it's a huge survey, so we have no idea what it is. And the brown ones, those are the non-responding cases. All right, with this, so what is this? As you see here on the first graph, you see you don't see any dips at all. Everything is really smooth, and that's what it we expect it to be. So because the data already edited, so you don't see a whole lot of deviation. However, moving on to the second graph, so this is the current data. We haven't yet edited.
Can you go to the conclusion?
All right, so we haven't yet edited the data, so you see a whole lot of dips, and that is what the analysts have to prioritize and focus on those, like the sector contributor or has like a major impact to the total estimate. All right, so I think okay, my time is up, so I am going to wrap it up and share with us the future work. So basically, the future work is we have to make use of big data and table blocks, and also use the pair the data to find out, okay, what we can do and what is going on in the system, and we try to build all those procedures and processes into the enterprise system. All right, so that concludes my talk for today. So if you have any questions, please let us know at the end, or what I give the contact information there. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So you have all listened to all this very interesting presentation. I'm sure you have questions for our presenters. I would suggest that we collect two or three questions and then we answer. I already see hands.
Okay, Siobhan Carey from...
Excuse me, please introduce yourself.
Yeah, Siobhan Carey from the Northern Ireland Statistics and Research Agency. So if we think that what gets measured gets managed, then how has introducing these sort of audits changed behavior on those producing the products?
Hello, everyone, and thank you for your very interesting presentations. I enjoyed them very much. I have a question for Mr. Beamer and for Mr. Nguyen. For Mr. Beamer, you said the cycle is going for 7 years, and I'm wondering if there are any plans about changes in concepts or questions or measures in Aspire. Because I didn't see great progress somehow. I expected in 7 years to see, wow, big improvement, at least for one project, for one product. But somehow I missed it. So do you perceive any changes in Aspire? And for Mr. Justin, I'm sorry I didn't get the time spent that you did this work, so could you tell us? And you mentioned these some reasons that they didn't document everything and so on. But again, now considering the time span, I'm wondering also if you notice, similar to the previous question, if you notice changes in behavior and perceptions of the statistics managers after your work. Thank you.
Thank you. Jolanta Szutkowska from Statistics Poland. Thank you very much for presentation, practical approach with regard to measurement and communication of quality. I need more clarification regarding monitoring mechanism in the implementation of improvements as the results of quality reviews. Are users involved in those quality reviews? And how you communicate and disseminate good practices or innovative practices identified during quality reviews? Thank you.
I think we can stop here. And there are, this last question maybe can answer it by also the other speakers in a way, because it's a general, I mean, we have some questions specific and one that is more general that maybe can be like around the tour de table. So maybe, I don't know, you will start answering to the first two questions on auditing.
Yeah, so changes in behavior as a result of conducting reviews and audits. At the moment, the new approach to NSQR and the first NSQR is still ongoing. But in terms of initial changes in behavior, I think I could say that there is much more work done in engaging the different statistical producers with, and it's a future-focused approach to these reviews with the weight put on adding value and trying to identify where development of new methods is needed and trying to tap into expertise outside GSS to get some advice and direction in how to go about doing this. I think for the first NSQR, more tangible results will be seen towards the end of the year. In terms of monitoring the improvements, for example, against recommendations for previous NSQRs, that's the NSQR wave that took place between 2012, 2014, 16. And there were reviews of individual outputs or set of outputs. And I think a conclusion that could be drawn is that some of the recommendations were not specific to those outputs or set of output statistics, and a system-wide approach was needed in terms of changing legacy systems, for example. And all that information is currently being acted upon in all the different transformation programs happening in the different government departments, at least in ONS. That is something that I can say.
Okay, thank you. You want to answer?
Sure.
You can take the
microphone. All right, great questions. And my question is how much time do we spend on the project, on the work? So, I think, okay, this is really difficult question because this is a continuing research. So what we do is if we identify the problems, we just recommend, okay, right away. For example, if we do the audit, so if we found that any survey that does not comply or in compliance with these quality standards, we give the analyst about 6 months to correct all those like suggestions or recommendations for improvement or anything that doesn't work. So they do have 6 months to correct all those problems. After 6 months, we give them another month. So that means all the audit team just like reevaluates all those. So if after that, the last month, if it doesn't work, therefore we have to book it just like a flag for that survey. So that's what we call to force them to work on this audit or like provide like a different methodology why that didn't work even though they corrected. So that is about the timelines and the time frames. And then another question is about how do we document all those requirement documentations. This one is really difficult, to be honest, because the culture, this is the culture change. So a lot of like staff have never done this before. So now, okay, we ask them to document all those like methodologies or whatever they did or they are going to do. To seem like it's really difficult to convince them to do that, because to adapt a new culture is really difficult, but to break a culture is even harder. So they just did exactly what they do, exactly what they did. And another thing we found is even though all those they will have the available documentation, doesn't mean that analysts just follow exactly what is written on that document. They tend to do what they believe it is. So we did that, and we found quite a few of surveys that analysts doesn't follow those documentation at all. They just like dig whatever the thing. Okay, that's it, the best way. So that is all the answer I have. Paul, gonna just answer this first of your questions.
Well, thank you for your question. I think I understood the question basically is, is the level or the trajectory of improvements that we're seeing from Aspire what we expected, or do we feel like, you know, there should have been more dramatic improvement than what we're seeing? And I think the way I would answer that is that, you know, there are sort of two types of change. You know, there's sort of disruptive innovation. Maybe you have a survey that you redesign and you expect dramatic changes, you know, cost savings, improvements in quality, that kind of things, because you're making a dramatic improvement. What we're trying to do with Aspire is continual improvement, incremental improvement, so that every year you're getting a little better and a little closer to optimal. And for example, this could be, for example, in the municipal accounts survey, we recommended that, they use a lot of editing in their processes. And we asked them to look at the data before and after editing and try to reconcile what's going on with the editing process. Are the edits having a positive effect? Are there some edits which are really not very effective, and maybe they could save money by not doing these edits? They actually did this before and after, and that actually revealed a lot of issues associated with the editing process. That was just one source of error. That's buried under data processing, okay? Maybe that's all they can do for 1 year. That's enough. So, you know, and then next year, maybe they'll, you know, in the labor force survey, they're working on non-response, and maybe they try something to try to increase response rates. It wasn't effective, so they try something else. That's not effective. So, you know, anything they do, they're having maybe only a 1 percentage point increment in the response rate from all of their efforts. So that's what we're dealing with here. And the other thing I would say is that these staff who are doing these quality improvements, they are fully engaged in other things that are just keeping the work going. So to add this on top of everything they're doing is quite asking quite a bit. There's a burden issue associated with that. So I think what we're seeing in Aspire is probably as good as it gets, unfortunately. It's going to be gradual, but hopefully it'll show some improvement every year.
Thank you. You want to say something?
Is there something? Perhaps on the question about users' involvement and publication regarding our quality exercise, I would just like to mention. First of all, the quality reports of the countries themselves are not publishable. This is in agreement with the countries and the overall assessment as well. But as I said, we have the general quality reporting publication that was published this May, which has a more general overview per sector, per table, per domain, with some specific cases mentioned. And as I said, I have it also here with me if somebody wants to meet me after in the coffee break, or also I can tell you where to look for it on Eurostat website and get some clicks and make our website team happier. And as for more specific results, we communicate that, of course, with data producers, so the statistical offices of the countries, perhaps presentations in all the meetings, all the task forces, for example, Task Force GFS, Task Force QSA, National Accounts Working Group. More detailed results are communicated there. And I would say that that's it. Then it's up to to the countries themselves to publish something if they wish.
I have a question for Owen. I would like to know if Statistics Norway is going to repeat this exercise with different scenarios to estimate bias for other surveys, and if you might think of adjusting also the estimates for measurement bias or non-response bias. In that case, no response.
That is obviously something we will look at to have a contrast. A non-response bias structure could be quite difficult, different in, say, labor force survey or EU Silk or something. So that's kind of a low-hanging fruit. But I'd like to say something about the changing of behavior, because what we do is that we have changed completely how we're thinking. We now produce estimates much quicker, which is preliminary estimates, and we put more effort into making a good reweighting models, and we collaborate with academia to get some idea of theoretical to so that when we, as Bimal mentioned, what's the effect of the adjustment model. So that's how we're thinking of this, that we can go for lower response rates, we can get much cheaper surveys, and we can get the results much easier out. And we are trying to produce this as part of the statistics. We don't hide this in the technical reports anymore, as we used to do. Did I answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Yes, thank you. Are there any other questions from the floor? I cannot see. No? I don't see. Okay. Then it's 10 o'clock. So we have the coffee break. And we can join. I ask you to join me to applaud the presenters. And I would like also to thank you for being here.